Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. We help companies achieve ambitious goals by strengthening leadership throughout the organization. I created this podcast to share ideas that you can use to become a more powerful and courageous leader. Here with me today is Mike Abrashoff. He wrote the book, It's Your Ship, Management Techniques from the Best Damn Ship in the Navy. It's a fantastic book. Mike is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis and was a military assistant to the former Secretary of Defense, the Honorable Dr. William Perry. Mike left the Navy in 2001 and co-founded GLS Worldwide. It's a fantastic book about his time turning around a big battleship in the Navy and what he learned from a leadership perspective, which is really useful to us, especially a couple of the key points that will come out here about what we need to do personally ourselves as leaders in order to be effective leading people. Mike, welcome to the show.
Pleasure being here. Thank you.
Mike, what's the big idea behind the book? Why did you write it?
Well, I was just doing what I was told to do. I was put in charge of this destroyer. It wasn't the worst ship in the Pacific Fleet, but it was probably third or fourth from the bottom. One of the highest accident rates of any ship in the Navy, one of the lowest retention rates. And when my predecessor left the ship for the final time with his parents and his wife and his kids, and as his departure was announced on the public address system, my new crew stood and cheered at the fact that he was leaving. And the first thought that went through my mind was, what do I have to do to keep that from happening to me 2 years from now when I leave the ship? But the second thought that went through my mind was, I wonder, as I was coming up through the ranks, how many of my sailors secretly cheered whenever I got transferred from one job to the next. And the answer is, I didn't know the answer. And because I didn't know, I wasn't as self-aware as I needed to be as to how I was showing up in front of the people I was trying to influence. And so I decided to change my leadership style and connect with our people better and engage them and treat them with respect and dignity, and to try to create a culture where I would be proud to have my own sons or daughters come be a part. And what happened was the crew turned their own ship around. I didn't turn the ship around. The crew didn't. And we got the trophy for best ship in the Pacific Fleet in 15 months. The same crew that was performing near the bottom got the award for best ship in the entire Pacific Fleet. And we got featured in Fast Company magazine and the Harvard Business Review. And trust me, I never thought to write a book, but literary agents called me and said, you should. And so after six or seven agents called, I decided to write a book. And the big idea behind the book is to stop obsessing over the things you can't influence and spend your days obsessing over the things that you can in order to drive performance and in order to keep your organization safe. I didn't get to choose my missions. I couldn't choose the people I work with. I couldn't go back and ask for more money. Yet so often we become obsessed over things we can't influence instead of saying, what can we influence and how do we be the best at it?
So that's great. And it's a great setup, right? So it's a setup that many leaders face and feel like they face every time they come into a new project, every time they come into a new role or position, which is you walk in, you're personally invested, you want to do a good job, not simply because you're committed to the outcome, that's important, but the reality is you also want to do a good job because you want to be that guy, you know, or that woman who comes in and is cheered by their employees and cheered by their colleagues, and where you have been helpful and supportive of the success of the people around you, and they see and appreciate that. And that's an honest reality of those of us who step into leadership, which is, yes, we have goals and outcomes we're trying to produce, and there's a personal piece to it, right? Which is that we want to be loved, and we want it to be respected, and we want to be, you know, kind of appreciated. And that's, and I think that's really important to have as part of this conversation.
It is, but when I saw my predecessor getting cheered off the ship, my other reaction was, this crew is never going to like me. But in order to keep them safe, and that's what drove me, it wasn't my next promotion. I never wanted to have to write their parents telling them that their sons or daughters weren't coming home because we didn't give it our best. So in order to keep them safe, I realized I was going to have to earn their respect and respect them in return as shipmates.
So here's my question. You see this guy get cheered off, and you are stepping into this role. What's your first few moves? What's the smartest thing you can do that you did or that you, in retrospect, see you could have done? What are the first few moves that you could recommend to someone stepping into that kind of a situation so that they give their leadership the best shot that it can be given?
Well, first off, I got my five department heads together, and I changed the way we evaluated them on their fitness reports. And it's very competitive. Only the top one or two ever get command of their own ship. And if you don't get command, your career is effectively over. And I changed the way we evaluated them. It was going to be based not on their individual performance, but on how well they collaborated with each other and how well they drove collaboration down to the lowest ranks in their department. It wasn't enough for them to collaborate. It was how well they drove it down to the lowest levels.
Great. So step one is make sure the people reporting to you work as a seamless team and that they're working together in alignment with what it is that you're trying to achieve.
Exactly right.
Beautiful. What's step two?
I got the whole crew together, all 310 of them. And as you can imagine, the military is very rank conscious and hierarchical.
I have a question for you, just a technical question, never having been on a battleship except for the Intrepid, which I don't think has left for years. What happens when you get all of the crew together? Does the ship just stop?
Well, we were in port at the time.
Okay, good. I was just curious about that. Okay, good. So you were tied to something and there was no danger.
Exactly. But to your point, if we're at sea, I can't get them all together. otherwise, the ship, something bad would happen.
Right.
We weren't doing our job.
Which I have to say is a great metaphor and a reality for many of us who run businesses that can't stop at a certain point. You can't just stop the action. You're changing tires while the car's moving kind of thing. Everything has to keep moving. So it's a great metaphor.
It is. But I got the whole crew together and I said, I don't care what your rank is. I don't care what your age is. I don't care how long you've been in this organization. From this day forward, it's okay to come to work every day and challenge every process, every procedure, every custom, every tradition. And we're going to improve the ship every day. And I want your input as to how we can do it better. And so what happened was I started listening to the people on the front line who were doing the work every day for their ideas. And the foremost powerful words I asked them was, what do you think? Well, how would you solve this problem? And when they started, the first answer when I asked that of the sailor, he said, well, nobody's ever asked me to think. And I said, well, I'm expecting you to think, and I want you to challenge every process and every procedure. And look, I couldn't radically change the operations of a ship in the Navy, but we could improve every day. And that's what we tried to do, was to improve every process just a little bit every day.
Now, let me ask you a question, because I love that. And I think the most challenging part of that is for the leaders and what I would sort of call, I mean, I guess ego strength, right? The willingness to be challenged, right? That what you're basically saying is, I want you to ask questions. I want you to challenge things. I want you to tell me when I'm wrong and hold me to the standards that I'm holding. And I think for sure, everybody who's listening would probably say, yeah, that's right. That's the right thing to do, you know, for the sake of the objective that we're trying to achieve. On the other hand, how does it feel when people are saying, you know, Mike, I think you're making the wrong decision here. And maybe they say it over and over and over again. How do you manage your own emotions and also your authority?
So there were only three occasions when people could say that to me directly. One, if it's safety related, and if a sailor doesn't feel it's being addressed by the chain of command, they could come directly to me and talk to me about safety. The second was in the interviews. I interviewed every sailor individually on the ship, all 310 of them. It was an enormous undertaking. I spent 20 to 25 minutes with each sailor, and I would ask them point blank, if you own this ship, what would you change? If you were the captain, what do you like most? What do you like least? What would you change? And so they could be free and honest with me then. And then I lifted an idea from the Army. And it's a process that after every event, after everything they did, everybody involved would get together to critique it. And they talk about what it was they were trying to do, what worked, what the conditions were at the time. What would they do better or differently next time if they see the same situation? And on Benfold, I added three criteria. You check your ego at the door. There's no retribution for what gets said. And anybody could respectfully challenge anybody in an AAR. The lowest ranking sailor could challenge the captain in an AAR. But outside of those three scenarios, people just can't come up to me and say, you're an idiot. You know, what are you thinking? There has to be, I do have to maintain the authority as a captain, and they do have to respect the chain of command. And so I forced them to use their chain of command for their ideas. And it forced my officers and chiefs to become better leaders as well.
Can you share AAR, what that stands for?
After action review.
After action review. That's the postmortem, in a sense, that you were just describing. So what you do is you've created certain boundaries within which people can behave in a certain way. And outside of those boundaries, they kind of go back to the flow of command.
Exactly. Because at the end of the day, say I've got a missile coming at the ship and I give the order to shoot. You know, I can't have a sailor raise his hand and say, Captain, have you thought of this? You right. know, there are times when the captain has to be directive and tell what's going to happen. But if everything is a crisis, then nothing is a crisis. And so we prepared for that crisis in peacetime by improving discipline, by improving engagement, by improving ownership. And that prepared us for the times when, you know, we were in a crisis situation and have to launch weapons.
It's really a great point and a great model, right? Which is to say create time and space for people to challenge and to argue and to, you know, with no repercussions, and then you go back to a normal process. It actually reminds me of, you know, a lot of religions that in a different way will say, you know, you work 6 days a week, and then on the seventh day, we're going to create holy space, sacred space, and time more than space. Like these next 24 hours, you don't do anything you were doing beforehand, and then you go back to doing what you were doing before. And it's there's an echo of that in this, which is to say, create ritualized, boundaried space in which people can bring out everything they need to bring out, and it doesn't disrupt the flow of the ship.
Exactly. I wish I could tell you I created it. The Army created it. We just perfected it and adapted it to our own DNA and made it work for us.
And hopefully our listeners can adapt it also, because it's something that's adaptable not just to the Army or to the Navy. And I think it's big of you to take something from the Army and bring it into the Navy and announce that, because I imagine there's at least on the football field some competition, but also in, you know, possibly in other places. But it's a great, you know, it's a great model. The AAR.
I think so. And it helped us improve business outcomes.
So the first thing you did, you got together your top five people and you really focused, you changed their incentive to collaboration versus individual performance. You brought 320, you said?
310.
310. I added 10 people to your force. 310 people together. And you told them what you expected of them, and then you met with each person to find out what it is that they would want to do differently and what they learned. What's your next step?
Well, I can't overestimate the importance of the interviews, because in the interviews I got to know their names, their spouses' names, their children's names, and I found out what motivated them. And most people think everybody is motivated by money. And, you know, money is important, but economics are only one of seven motivators that motivate people. People can be motivated politically, they can be individualistic, they can be altruistic, they can be aesthetically motivated. And if you don't understand what motivates the people you're working with, you may not be effective when trying to motivate them to achieve, you know, above average results. And so in these interviews, I got to know each sailor and where they were coming from and where they wanted to go. And it enabled me to connect with them and engage with them better so that they felt like I cared about them, and I did, and so that they had an incentive to perform at a higher level.
That's really powerful. So how did and actually you have examples of this throughout the book, where given individuals you made certain exceptions for people. You addressed individual needs individually.
I did.
And what I wonder about
is rare in the military because normally it's one size fits all.
Right. And that's what I wonder about. So I wonder about the tension between that kind of individualized approach and the need that I hear leaders talk about all the time of consistency, the need for kind of rules in a sense. And I would think, especially in the armed forces, you know, in the Navy, you have that even more so for the reasons you get before. When you say shoot a missile, you got to make sure people shoot a missile, and there needs to be some consistent approach to kind of management. And you broke that in many ways to great success. So how do you balance that? How do you manage that dynamic?
I had a rule that if what we were doing appeared on the front page of the Washington Post tomorrow, would we be proud or embarrassed? And if we were embarrassed, we didn't do it. But if I could defend it and if it looked good on the front page of the newspaper, you can't go wrong. And to give you an example, we were based in San Diego, very high cost of living area. Military doesn't get paid well in relation to the private sector. And many of my sailors had to live an hour and a half, 2 hours away from San Diego. Some lived in Tijuana because the housing was cheaper there. And I found out, you know, we had work hours that started at the end of rush hour and were over when rush hour started. And sailors were not only wasting time and stuck in traffic, they were wasting money with gas and whatnot. So one sailor in the interview recommended, can we change the work hours? Instead of starting at 7:30 in the morning, start at 6 in the morning and then end early in the afternoon. What's not to like? And so we changed work hours. There was one sailor, John Rafalco, who lived in Escondido, which was 45 miles away. He and his wife could only afford one car, and John took the trolley to work every day. And so he put in a request to continue showing up at 7 in the morning, and he would stay longer in the afternoon. His whole chain of command said no because they were conditioned to say no, and they were conditioned not to deviate from the standards. And I'm here thinking, I can put myself in John Rafalco's shoes, you know, not being able to afford a second car, and this is going to pose a hardship on him. And so I went against his whole chain of command, and I approved his request to alter his work hours. And he not only gave me an extra hour and a half in the afternoon, some days he would stay till 5 or 6 just because he took ownership, he took pride. I got more work hours from him by giving him that one break than I would have gotten if I had made him buy another car.
And how do you then manage the rest of your chain of command that you've just sort of overruled in this situation?
It was tough. They had to learn what drove me. And what I usually come down for, I root for the underdog. And officers and chiefs, they can take care of themselves. I'm rooting for that young enlisted kid, you know, who's making $25,000 a year, doing everything they can, doing everything right. They're using the military as a way to start their climb on the economic ladder. I always root for the underdog. I would always try to find a way to say yes for a young enlisted sailor. And I'll be honest, I had higher expectations for my officers and chiefs, and I probably didn't cut them the same amount of slack that I did junior people because the system is stacked against junior people. And I wanted to make them feel like they had a voice and that they would be heard.
And they may have respected the fact that at least you were consistent by rank, meaning you're treating all of those officers and chiefs in the same way for the most part.
Sure.
Right. You said something really interesting in the book about diversity training versus unity training. Can you explain that?
So the government has requirements for mandatory diversity training. It can take up to 5 days of sitting in the classroom. And what happens is when you're done, you come off more agitated and more upset than when you went in. And when I took command of the ship, my ship was the first ship built from the keel up to accommodate both men and women. We had serious sexual harassment problems on the ship. We had racial prejudice on the ship. And so if you have that, then your diversity training is ineffective.
Right.
If something's ineffective, I'm getting rid of it or making it work. And so I just changed the name to unity training, and it was the same elements as what was in our diversity training. It just came off of with We need to work together. We're stronger when we're unified than if we're divided. And that's a message for the country, to be honest with you, because right now we feel divided. I don't think we're as divided as we think we are. We all, you know, love this country. We will all want it to be the best. But yet it's in some people's narrow political interest to divide us so that they get votes and gain popularity. I'm more for the politician who wants to unite us. And what I wanted to do, I got rid of diversity training, installed unity training, get people to realize that it takes all kinds to make a ship work, different levels of skill, different levels of rank, different levels of responsibility, different genders, different levels of creativity. And you treat each other with respect and dignity, and you treat each other in the manner in which you yourself want to be treated by me. And when I interviewed every sailor on the ship, I would ask them, is there sexual harassment on the ship? Is there racial prejudice on the ship? And if I heard about it, I got to the bottom of it. So what I wanted to do was the crew to be unified. And when you're unified, you work together better as a team, you collaborate better, and you produce results.
It's interesting. Just the name itself shifts the outcome or the goal. Like, diversity drives us, you're saying, to diversity, whereas unity drives us to unity. And so that you still, even in the context of the unity training, you're still letting people, encouraging people to express the uniqueness of who they are, but in the service of creating unity as opposed to creating diversity.
Exactly right.
Super interesting. Mike, I have to say it was such a pleasure to read your book and such a pleasure to talk to you. And I want to also say I receive a lot of books, right? I get a lot of books from people that now that I'm doing this podcast. And you wrote me a personal note in the book that you sent me. And it's the first book that I've received where, even from people that I know, and you and I are friends now, but we didn't know each other before I read your book. And it actually touched me. It meant a lot. And, you know, I said to my wife, it's kind of interesting because I'm reading, you know, how he approached his crew. And just the fact that he wrote this note to me in the book makes me feel something towards him, makes me feel like connected, makes me feel like he took the time to just write my name in there, write a little note and send it to me, as opposed to, you know, a kind of typewritten note with some PR notes. And so I want to say that I both appreciate it, and it's so reflective of how you lead and how you operate that it immediately gave me a sense of the way you live what you write, which is, you know, which is always really important. So thank you for being on the show. Mike Abrashoff, It's Your Ship, Management Techniques from the Best Damn Ship in the Navy. Thank you so much for being with us, Mike.
Thank you, Peter, for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.